It is December the 28th, 2018, and this is episode 5 of the official podcast of the Royal New Zealand College of Urgent Care. Coming up on this episode, we discuss the various objects and other paraphernalia commonly ingested over the Christmas period. We discuss antibiotic use for cough in children, and we look at safely safety netting your consultations. So welcome to episode 5 of the Royal New Zealand College of Urgent Care's podcast. My name is Guy Melrose and I'm your host. I'm joined as ever by Dr. David Sorrell, our Director of Clinical Training. Hello, David.
Hello, everyone.
Now, this is going to be a shorter episode than normal, and that's because it's the 28th of December and it's Christmas, so everyone's out having fun or working hard, one or the other. And so we're just going to recap some of the things that have been brought up in our Urgent Bite, Christmas Bites rather, the 12 Bites of Christmas, as well as look back at a couple of the Urgent Bites from earlier in the month. So there was a little bit of a trend in some of those 12 bites, Dave, which was ingestion of things that shouldn't be ingested. So we had coins and magnets and batteries, and also those little packets of silica that come in various toys and gifts, and plants that are around the house on Christmas. So you also posted on Facebook that study that looked at how fast it takes to transit your gut when you swallow a piece of Lego brick or a Lego head, wasn't it? So if we start with, let's take magnets. Quite common for kids to have magnets to play with, and if they swallow them, if it's one magnet, that's not considered too much of a problem if it makes it to the stomach, because it's much like a coin. But if there's two or more, that can cause problems, can't it?
Yes. So I do remember a case that my registrar had earlier this year. And so the thing is that the rules for ingestion are believe everything you're told and believe nothing you're told. So there was a young child that mum was concerned had swallowed some magnets, and the child adamantly said that they hadn't swallowed any. They absolutely not, definitely hadn't. And the registrar was very concerned and said, look, I think we should do an x-ray. And then went through the protocol of getting the x-ray, which we certainly can talk about how complicated that is, certainly in Auckland with regulations with ACC and other options. Anyway, they got the x-ray and there were 5 magnets in the intestine. And so that patient went through to hospital. And they managed to give an agent to make the child pass, and the magnets passed out fairly rapidly, and x-rays revealed they'd gone. So you have a child that says, I definitely didn't swallow anything, and you have radiographic evidence that they were there and they probably would cause problems. And then sometimes you have a child that says, you know, I absolutely did swallow it, and you do a radiograph and it's not there. So believe everything you hear and believe nothing you hear. Obviously, when you're talking about coins, they can lodge in the upper esophagus and therefore can be a problem. But if your radiograph shows they're past the lower esophageal sphincter and pretty much into the stomach, you know they're going to continue to pass without a problem. But are they coins or are they magnets? And so that's where you have to work out with various ways by looking at the images and the history combined, because you don't want to get it wrong when it comes to button batteries, because they're very, very nasty. And my interesting discussions with ACC is they may possibly accept an ACC claim when a button battery has been ingested and it has caused major trauma. But I gather that in Auckland ACC, you have to be very specific. And if there hasn't actually been an injury, it's not covered by ACC. So there are some challenges that we face, even though you know you need to do some imaging.
Yeah, I think that's the important thing, isn't it? That if there's a story that there could be ingestion, an X-ray is an imperative. But how do you get that X-ray done? And in the private urgent care clinics, it either means a parent is paying for the X-ray, or the clinic will end up paying for it if you put it through a funding pathway like ACC or the primary options pathways. If they then decline it, it kind of lands in your clinic's lap to pay for the imaging. But the alternative is to send them to hospital to get a publicly funded X-ray, but that then clogs up the emergency department with somebody who may have a negative X-ray and have been sent home from your clinic. So I gather in Auckland you've got a certain thing involving the paediatricians, is that right?
So the situation is wherever you work, find out what the protocol is and how it works, because it will be different everywhere. In Auckland, we have had some communications that state you are only allowed to do a radiograph or a plain radiograph under the age of 15 when you have talked to a paediatrician. So the protocol is to lodge a form, you ring a paediatrician and say, I would like to do an X-ray. Can I have your name, please? And if they give you your name and permission to do the X-ray, then you can. If they don't give you a name and permission, you're not allowed to do the X-ray. Then the primary options will accept that claim when it goes through. If there is an injury as well, then that can be worked out retrospectively. But it can be very dodgy to do an ACC form for coins, magnets, and batteries, because it's possible that ACC could turn it down. I find that the Upper North Island is more difficult to deal with ACC, and you have to follow guidelines very carefully. And I've had some very, very constructive talks with ACC, and they're more than willing to accept fish bones now, where you are eating food and the fish bone gets lodged and you feel there's a fish bone there. That will almost universally be acceptable as an accident if you want to do a radiograph. Not that the radiograph may show the fish bone, but with other things, if there's no history of vomiting and blood and abrasions, etc., then they have certainly a right to turn down the ACC claim. So I try to encourage the people I work with to not put in claims that can be declined.
It's an interesting one with bones. How do you manage the story of I was eating fish or some kind of meat, and there's a feeling by the patient that there's something lodged in their throat? And you might do an X-ray that doesn't show any particular foreign object, be it a fish bone or a small sliver of chicken bone or something, but the patient's still adamant there's something there. When do you involve ENT, or when is it considered just like a scratch that will take time to heal over and settle? You know, when are you committing them to a more formal kind of ENT exam? Do you have any sort of rules around that one?
My rules are 24 hours. So if it's been more than 24 hours and they still have a foreign body sensation, it's reasonable to do an X-ray, but I would not trust the X-ray. And then it's reasonable to refer them for a view. Now, that's when life becomes complicated. So which department and wherever you work, it may be gastroenterology or it may be ENT. It depends where the foreign body is. And sometimes you have to negotiate with the two services. Generally, upper is ENT and lower is gastro, but again, local policies apply. I feel very comfortable talking to ENT or gastro 24 hours after ingestion, unless they're highly symptomatic. Or if you do a radiograph and you do find a foreign body, so it's a bit hit and miss, and it's certainly reasonable to wait 24 hours. If it's more than 24 hours, they probably should have someone have a look and determine whether it is just an abrasion.
They can be quite distressing though, can't they? Is there anything that you give people? Because a gargle pretty much only covers the area that you can see with the naked eye anyway. So do you give anybody anything for these symptoms of
foreign? Well, that's a million-dollar question, isn't it? I don't know that there's any study showing anything that is absolutely wonderful. You certainly can. If you're saying, well, they've got an abrasion, you can give them omeprazole, you can give them a pink lady or a lignocaine with Mylanta. I don't really have, or Gaviscon, any certain pathways that I'm dealing with, because if I'm sending them in, I'm sending them in. I don't mind giving a single dose of omeprazole and Gaviscon on Mylanta, but I don't have a set protocol for it.
And talking of that Facebook post, the have you got any details to hand about it was published in the BMJ, wasn't it? That was one of their Christmas episodes where they got some clinicians to swallow some pieces of Lego and then time how long it took to transit their digestive tract. And because that's the question, if I see somebody who swallowed a coin or a kid who swallowed a coin and the x-ray shows that it's very much within the stomach and out of danger, the question is, how long will it take to pass and do they need to keep getting it checked? And anytime I've spoken with any pediatric surgeon, they say, no, don't, unless the child gets symptoms of abdominal pain or vomiting, you don't need to re-x-ray them on transit. But parents want to know, how long does it take and do I need to check the stool to confirm that it's out? So how long would a coin, or how long did the Lego heads take to pass? Because I think from my memory of it, one came through quite quickly and one wasn't found at all.
Yes, I'm just looking at the page now, and I think, there's quite a few comments on it. I think it was, so the score was an average of 1.71 days, and it was the lovely description was the primary outcome was the found and retrieval time, otherwise known as the FART score. So the FART score average was 1.71 days. And the interesting thing about this study is, of course, it's been widely reported throughout the world now. It's been on the United States talk shows and everything. So it's one way to become extremely famous, doing a very small, very simple study swallowing Lego.
Well, I'm sure it's the peak of their notoriety is to have appeared on the official podcast of the Royal New Zealand College of Urgent Care. So they've peaked now. They can finish. So 1.71 days for a piece of Lego in an adult. So, but do you have any, do you tell parents when the kid has got a confirmed coin to check, or do they, because I'm pretty sure that most I've dealt with want to know that it's out, but it does mean sifting through every bowel movement. Yeah.
Do you really want to go through the motions? So usually the advice is it should pass within a week. I note that one of the cases for the Lego head was unsighted at 2 weeks. Their final conclusion is, we suggest parents do not need to check their children's stools following an accidental ingestion of four small plastic foreign bodies. Now, if that's a coin, I think you can pretty much transcribe the same things, that a coin is not that different and not going to be toxic regardless. So if there's acute abdominal pain or vomiting, straight into hospital. General advice is we don't routinely re-image them. So it should pass within 2 weeks. It may pass within 2 days.
But then magnets and batteries, obviously coin batteries, is an imperative to refer straight away.
Acutely referred for those. And the other thing, I guess, that we haven't actually talked about is the dishwasher packet ingestion. So there's been a trend around the world of challenged young people being challenged to swallow dishwasher capsules, and some horrendous gastrointestinal damage has occurred from the result of those. And those are extremely caustic and must be referred immediately to the emergency department for review. And that's another thing to consider, because if you look at these things, they're brightly colored, they look like lollies, and they should really be put away very high and out of the way. And I just thinking, I'm sure that mine are in a place that could be easily child accessible. When you've got young children, you obviously think about these things. And as your kids get older and leave home, you forget about the toxicities. And so when at Christmas time and places, times like that, there are young people visiting, and you should consider what's toxic in your house.
And moving on to two other bites of Christmas that we'll be featuring. There are a number of things at Christmas time that come out around the house that maybe aren't there during the rest of the year. Some of them are plants, such as mistletoe and holly. And there's even those little silica packs that come in wrapped in with usually electronic equipment and things to keep the dryness, the humidity down. And kids will probably present with any number of different ingestions. And I guess my personal rule is I always phone the poison centre to double check. Because even sometimes I had a case a while back where a child had, mum had found an empty pot of Vicks vapor rub. And I remember playing around with that as a kid and probably eating some as well. And I immediately assumed it was probably fine because it's something that kids get smeared all over them. And I phoned the poison center just as a matter of rule, and they said that can be quite serious because of the camphor oil that's in there. And they recommended ED level observing for all kinds of arrhythmias and other symptoms that can develop over 6 hours. So I was taken aback at how I'd assumed, oh, that'll be fine. But then the poison center outlined there's actually something more serious. So my general rule is that whenever anybody's eaten something they shouldn't, I find out what it is and check with the poisons people, because they've got the mine of all the up-to-date information.
Yes, and if in doubt, ring them up is a very, very good rule, because obviously that's why Vicks have the baby balm for the younger children, and certainly cases of children under two getting seizures and toxicity from camphor is a well-known thing, but you're not going to know everything. I remember an interesting case in the emergency department of eucalyptus oil toxicity. So a child swallowed eucalyptus oil in the bathroom, I think it was, having a bath, and was not looked after very carefully for a short period of time, and came in virtually GCS of 3, comatose. And so some of those essential oils can be exceedingly toxic. And another thing, obviously, around this time of year, if we broaden our aspect to what happens to our furry friends, things like toxic chocolate toxicity and also caraca fruit. Caraca fruit and caraca nuts are very toxic, and dogs will ingest those and become very unwell. So if your furry friend also gets unwell, consider chocolate and caraca berries.
Yeah, it's that time of year when people are having fun and partying and, you know, imbibing all the good stuff, and things get left around, don't they? And certainly watch batteries are things that come with lots of gadgets and toys and remote controls and things. And it doesn't take a second to have put something down and for a little person to have swallowed it, or a little furry person as well. So I guess being sensible and putting everything out of the way. Another interesting thing I found I think it was through the poison center, they also mentioned how when, you know, it might be granny and grandpa come to visit and they might bring all their medications, and they've got to be careful to leave them somewhere safe, because at home they don't normally do that, but then they've come to see the grandkids. So there's all sorts of little hidden ingestion problems that you've got to be aware of in and around Christmas. If we just go back to a couple of weeks ago, we did an urgent bite that looked at a study that had in the British Journal of General Practice that looked at antibiotic use in children with cough. And there was this assertion made by them that, or the writers of the study, that a lot of GPs will prescribe antibiotics just in case, for fear of a child getting worse. And they looked at a 30-day outcome for kids with cough and found that whether they ended up worse and in hospital or re-presenting didn't have anything to do with whether or not somebody was given that antibiotic just in case. And that tied in a little bit with the Facebook post you put up about lower respiratory tracts and tract infections with kids. So I wonder what your thoughts are on cough and kids and antibiotics and also delayed script, which was the other part of the that study that prevents re-presenting. So have you any thoughts on that today, Dave?
So obviously you have the issues around, do I really want to give an antibiotic for a child with a viral illness? And there's always the debate, because parents seem to be unhappy sometimes if they're not given an antibiotic. So under certain circumstances, a back pocket prescription may be reasonable. But in actual fact, what's more important is the safety netting safety netting advice, that, you know, if the child becomes more unwell, then what's the plan? You know, are they going to be reviewed? Do they need to go to hospital? The 31st of December is another update about the eternal decision of management of children, home or hospital. And again, it explores those sorts of situations. Sometimes it's a case of what you do versus what you say. And I'm certainly very proactive in saying, don't prescribe an antibiotic all the time. And yet in my own practice, sometimes I prescribe an antibiotic. But it's not necessarily just in case. It's a back pocket prescription to say, if they are worse, I try my best not to do it, but I find sometimes that I can't help myself. And that's an internal thing, I guess, that decision-making wise, we're worried we're going to miss something. However, it's never going to work if the child has a severe septic infection anyway. So why we do it is hard to know sometimes.
One thing I do when I give a back pocket script is I write on the, after the, you know, one tablet QDS or whatever, I'll put in brackets back pocket prescription or delayed script, so that the pharmacist sees that when it's cashed in, and they know the date that it's been prescribed, and then they'll often have a conversation with the patient at that time to say, you know, why are you starting this now, or, you know, do you need to actually see a doctor because you look worse? Because it's that, I guess one fear is that if you give somebody a script for a delayed script and they're getting worse, are they getting worse and actually should be representing and being seen?
And that's all about that safety netting advice.
Yeah, which brings us to the next urgent bite, which we kind of framed around that story by Bruce Arrell about the child in Canada who vomited on him, which prompted him to keep him in hospital, and it turned out the child had meningitis. And I referenced the study that had found that a lot of GPs stated that they used gut instinct when deciding to safety net certain consultations. So safety netting is obviously an important thing, particularly in urgent care, because we might not know the patient as well as a GP will for a registered patient. And what do you have any kind of thoughts on safety netting? It's because it's quite a personal thing for each person at the end of the day, but it's an important thing for people to do.
Yes, I was reading something else that I haven't actually posted about sepsis and in children, and I was just trying to find a copy of it, and it was interesting that they had a whole lot of pediatricians talking about how they determined, and it was some very interesting things that one of the things is electronic device use. And they said that a well child will concentrate on the iPhone, and a sick child will be listless and can't concentrate. And then another thing is not to confuse hunger with eating. And one pediatrician had said that he remembered a child that died of meningitis, and had said that the child had said they were hungry, but in actual fact, they weren't hungry, because they hadn't actually been observed to eat. And so eating is a good sign. Hunger is not necessarily a good sign in child, because it may mean that they're actually got abdominal pain or something else, and not necessarily actually be that well. And so everyone has their own sort of cues as to how they can determine whether sepsis is present or not.
And I personally use quite a lot of handouts for part of the safety netting, because it obviously lists the things that are important. So if you've had a head injury, there's the head injury guidelines that clearly state what you should be aware of. There's good fever guidelines and dehydration advices. So I think handouts are a useful tool in explaining, because it's quite hard sometimes to gauge how much a patient or a parent actually takes from what you say to them, and you might tell them to bring their child back if they're deteriorating and if they get a fever or they start vomiting or whatever. But unless they've heard you and understood you, they might not take that on board. And I don't know how you can gauge whether or not they have understood. I don't know what your tricks are around that, Dave, but it's, I find a handout is certainly a good thing because then they've got something to reference.
So I always give a handout. So I have a variety of handouts that I've saved on the local hard drive. So I have a handout for safe cough mixtures in children, managing coughs and colds, gastroenteritis. And I, since last week, I've actually added a new one, which is called safety netting. And it's called, these are the things I would be worried about. If they happen with your child, immediately take them to medical attention at the hospital or here. And so it's, you know, severe pain, uncontrollable shivering, lethargy, a list of things. And I like to give them out because I don't expect that they're going to remember everything that's told to them. And from the list I've just discovered of pediatricians' thoughts, so most reassuring behavior is actively energetic. So they found that to be very, very useful. Use of an electronic device and consolable is slightly reassuring. Moderately reassuring is energetic, smiling and laughing, chatting and bubbling. And so those are some interesting things. But I think giving some written information is always useful when there's uncertainty. And there's always uncertainty with pediatric fever.
Mm. And it's difficult, isn't it? Because parents obviously know their children very well. And if they bring a child in because they're concerned, you might be looking at a child and thinking, this child is running around like crazy. They look very well. I can't find anything wrong with them. And they might be saying to you, but they've got a very high pain threshold. Or I often get told, oh, the last time he was admitted with pneumonia, he looked like this. And yes, you think, well, I still think they look well and the numbers don't support it. So it can be a really tricky thing dealing with those sorts of dynamics as well in a consultation.
And sometimes you get through a consultation and you're not getting that final rapport. And so I often will say, you know, is there one particular thing that you're worried about? And sometimes it will come through that, you know, there's a child down the road that's had meningitis and I'm really, really worried about that and he's just not right. And parental concerns should always be respected because parents know their children. We don't know their children. And if they're really worried about something, you're in a minefield if you ignore it. You can reassure as much as you like, but if you're wrong, it's not going to be great. And so, you know, I will often make an offer. Would you like to be referred to the emergency department? And if the answer is a strong yes, then it's their time. And who am I to say that's not the right thing to do? Whereas sometimes, you know, if they're happy at the end, then that's the way to go.
Yeah, I did that just recently. There was a young baby who had seen the GP that morning and then was seeing me that afternoon. And I couldn't really find anything that changed the GP's management. But it worried me a little bit that it was the second visit of the day. And I ended up speaking to the paediatrician, the peds reg on call, and we agreed that, yep, it sounds like they're okay to go home, but they took the referral and it was left with mum, you can take your child up to the hospital if you feel they're getting worse and the paediatrician will see you. And she was happy with that kind of option. So she didn't go straight away. And I don't know whether she, I have not heard whether she has, did end up going, but it was kind of I felt better because I'd felt, well, I don't want to be the second person she's seen today and miss something. But then I wanted to give her the chance to get some higher care if needed. And so I do sometimes do that when make a referral, but without necessarily the patient going straight away, but it's kind of a backup plan.
Yeah, it's important to have a happy parent and to listen to their concerns. And certainly if it appears that they're not happy at the end of the consultation, you've got to look at why, especially if there's, you know, if you're the second, third, fourth, fifth doctor seeing a child, then you've got to have some warning bells going that, you know, what's going on here? What's being missed? Is there anything important in the important list that I'm not considering?
Yeah, so it's important doctors have gut instincts that they should listen to, and mums and dads will have their gut instincts too, and the two have to kind of find a way to meld together and do what's best for the patient at the end of the day. And I guess the way I kind of justify things with myself is I'd rather refer a patient who ends up being observed in hospital for a bit and sent home than the alternative of sending somebody home who deteriorates and becomes very unwell at home. So whilst I'd feel bad if I've wasted someone's time at the hospital, I'd rather feel bad about that than bad about the other side of things. So I guess you've always got to find your level of comfort and stick to it, and don't ignore your gut. So if it doesn't make you feel good, don't be forced to do something that doesn't Absolutely. Make you feel good. Great. So I think, like I say, a shorter episode today just to augment those things, but we've got lots of good little clinical information's coming through from the Urgent Bites over this Christmas period. We've got no nurse's station for this episode, but that will be back in the next episode. And just going forwards into January and beyond, there's lots hopefully planned for the podcast that will come to fruition, lots of interesting talks and things planned to try and make this as educational and enjoyable for people. I'd like to thank you, Dave, for your help since the inception in August, late August of this podcast. I hope people who are listening enjoy it, and I'm sure that they learn from your expertise that you bring to this each month. And I look forward personally to developing this further next year and having more fun and learn lots from it. And I hope everybody has a happy Christmas and a successful 2019. And likewise to yourself, Dave. If I hope you get some rest because you've had a busy few months with the exams and everything. So, are you working over Christmas, or are you going to get a break?
I'm off on New Year's Eve and New Year's Day, but I'm mostly working.
Yeah, so those of you listening, some of you will be working, some of you will be on holiday. I hope you all have good Christmases, whether working or not. And I certainly look forward to seeing you all again in the new year. So it'll be a goodbye from Dave.
Goodbye and Happy New Year.
And that's a goodbye from me. We'll see you next year. Thanks for listening. The information discussed in this podcast was intended for the ongoing professional development of qualified health professionals and should not be used for self-diagnosis. For any personal medical concerns, please consult your usual doctor.